The problem with Christians, as everybody knows, is that you're all idiots. Let's be honest about it. There's no way you can possibly believe in the Bible. It's a book of fairy tales. It's a novel that's been strung together by a bunch of ancient goat herders and peasants to justify the existence of their nation and claim the resurrection of some fictional God-man that no one can really prove ever even existed. Have you heard that before? I'm seeing nods. I certainly have. And really, that's the question that we need to answer this morning. It's the question that if you're a believer, it's something you need to be prepared to answer. If you're here this morning and you actually genuinely want the answer to this question, well, you're in the right place for that too. By the end of this morning, you will have the answer. But I'm going to give you mine in advance. Job done. What I want to do this morning is, I'm not going to go through any big preamble here. I want to have a look at a number of very concrete, very grounded, quite literally, evidences for the historicity of the Bible. We're going to be going through 10. I'm going to be doing a top 10 list in the 21st century style. No self-respecting 21st century man should do anything other than a top 10 list, I'm sure. But you might wonder, what do I have to do with this anyway? Some of you know me well, some of you don't know me at all. History is something that I am deeply invested in and love. It was part of the topic of my time at uni. I did a combined history and English degree and went on to do honours again in history and English, Shakespeare actually, which probably explains a lot about me. But it is something I have a great deal of interest in. I'm not going to go in any more detail than that about me. I want the evidence to speak for itself. So let's start with number 10, the camel conundrum. This is a really interesting one. The first historical discovery that we have today actually leads us into some pretty unusual territory. But for a very long time, one of the most common arguments against the historicity of the Bible actually had an awful lot to do with camels. It might sound like a weird thing to fixate on, but it's important for a really interesting reason, and that is that historians considered the way that the Bible talks about camels to be anachronistic. That's a big word, so I'm going to explain you what that means. If something's anachronistic, it means it's out of time, right? It's been picked up at something that we're all familiar with, and a writer at some point has written about something way off in the past, and they've talked about it like it's normal, not realizing that at that point in history it wasn't normal at all, right? What that means here is it's actually a fairly simple argument. The argument is that a lot of the early stories in the Bible involve people traveling from point A to point B on one of these. And the argument that's being made by historians is they actually didn't ride camels in the Middle East at that point in history. They weren't domesticated yet. We're going to read some scripture. If you're wondering why we didn't have a Bible reading before all of this, it's because I've got a bunch of them, and they're all part and parcel of what we're doing in sequence. I'll get out of the way a little bit for this, actually, because I know I'm going to be in some people's way. So if you don't have a Bible in front of you, everything is going to be on the screen. Because I was lazy, it's actually not going to be in NIV, so you can follow along on the screen if you like. So we're talking about Abraham. Now, Abraham was old. He was well advanced in age, and the Lord had blessed Abraham in all things. So Abraham said to the oldest servant of his house who ruled over all that he had, "Go to my country and to my family and take a wife for my son Isaac." Then the servant took 10 of his master's camels and departed, for all his master's goods were in his hand, and he arose and went to Mesopotamia to the city of Nahor. And he made his camels kneel down outside the city by a well of water at evening time, the time when women go out to draw water. Now, if you know the story here, it's actually a beautiful love story between Isaac and Rebekah. But you can see the conflict here between a historian's perspective and the Bible's. We're talking about, top of the screen there, 2200 BC. And the argument's being made that camels actually weren't domesticated in the Middle East, at least for another 1200 or so years. It's about 1000 BC when we first start to see camels being domesticated. So the Bible's wrong, right? That's actually seems like a fairly reasonable conclusion. And in fact, it was the conclusion that a lot of historians drew until this. Now, it's going to be a little bit iffy how much you can see. I've got multiple slides, and there are some things here I'm going to point the slides out to you, or point out things on the slides a little bit more closely. So don't stress too much if you can't see exactly the detail I'm referring to, at least initially. By the way, if you have in front of you your little list of three major points and then the big idea here today was on that nope slide. No. History doesn't disprove the Bible, it confirms it. And what I'd like for you from your three points is pick three of these things, three of the most interesting things that you encounter in the sermon today, three of the things that really leap out at you, and write those down. And tell me something about them. So this is an embossed cast of what's known as a cylinder seal. I might get out of the way again, actually. I'm going to stand over here for a bit. For some context, these types of seals are used in the ancient world, and they're kind of like a signature. So today, if you've got a document that you really want to authenticate, you pop your signature on the bottom and everybody goes, oh, I know that signature. I know that person's actually genuinely signed this document. That's what these were for in the ancient world. They're actually very small, often worn around the neck, and they were used to make an impression into clay more often than not. And so that would authenticate that maybe I, Nebuchadnezzar, have actually sent this person out into the world. They have my authority. They are carrying with them my seal. They can speak for me. They can speak on my behalf. Now, it is a little bit tricky to see what it is that you're looking at here. What the detail we're after is this very corner here, and I'm going to show you a little bit more detail with this. What you can see, this is the actual seal. The last one was a cast of the seal as it was like rolled out. So what you're seeing here, you've actually got two figures who are sitting on a camel. They're sitting on a dromedary camel. There's one person on each hump, and they're actually divine figures. This is a piece of Sumerian art, and this actually comes from about 1900 BC. So we've now closed that time gap of 1,000 years where historians said nobody rode camels. We're now down to about 100 years into that sort of Bronze Age period. And you can see some really interesting things here, actually. There's a rosary at the top with wings. That's a really common piece of Sumerian design. And it shows that the people sitting beneath it are underneath the protection of the gods, or that they are gods themselves with a protective aura, which is what it is in this case. So this particular seal was actually discovered in 1928, and it was found among a really significant collection of clay tablets that had all kinds of interesting historical detail in them themselves. As another sort of slight side point here, I'm only showing you 10 things this morning. There's so much out there that could be, even just looking at this one thing, I could talk and focus on the tablets that were associated with this. They actually have evidence of Abraham in these tablets. He's mentioned as going to war against the kings of Sodom and so on. But this isn't even the oldest representation of people on camels out of the Middle East. This is. Isn't it cute? This is actually one of my favourite discoveries. And this was the one that sort of broke, as it were, the camel's back, because the story was, even when that seal was discovered, there was a bit of contention around, is this actually good enough evidence that we're going that far back in time? I mean, these are divine figures, right? It's not necessarily a representation of two humans on a camel. This changed all of that, because this camel is actually older than the last one. This one's from anywhere from 2800 to 2200 BC. And if you have a look down his neck, you can kind of see there are some two lines going all the way down, and there are a couple of lines going across. It's a harness. He's wearing a really beautiful little harness. I think that one's just amazing, really awesome. Confirms the story that, yes, absolutely, the Bible had it right. People were riding camels in 2200 BC. It's quite plausible. Number nine, the Shiloh complex. This one as well is a really interesting development in biblical archaeology. So this was discovered in 1922 initially by a team of archaeologists who came out of Denmark. And really, they were just a group of guys who were pretty obsessed with the Bible, and they wanted to go and see what they could find in Shiloh. Now, Shiloh was the site where, when the Israelites first arrived in the Promised Land, they had the tabernacle with them, which was a really large tent, essentially. And what they did was they worshipped God in this tent before the temple was built. Shiloh, being the site of the tabernacle, is an absolutely massive site, but it had all kinds of very concrete structures, not made of concrete, but you can see here, sort of bricks and mortar, that were built around the tabernacle complex. So that's what you're seeing here. Now, they knew what they were looking at because when they started to excavate here at Shiloh, they found an incredibly high concentration of bone. They found cattle, they found goats, they found sheep, they found pigeons, and on down the list it goes. And if you go and look at the Old Testament text, you have a look in the book of Leviticus and you see what kind of things were they offering in the tabernacle, it reads like a list of exactly what they found at this site. They also found really large jars that were used for storing all kinds of different things in them, actually, water being one of the primary uses for purification and so on. But they also found jars that had very rich and expensive oils in them that were used in the temple. And that's really important because you can sample those things even thousands of years later. You can find residue of those things on the jars and in the fabric of the jars. It's very testable. So all of this, of course, was dated, and they found that the cattle bones in particular ranged from about 1400 BC to 1170 BC. And that is exactly the time period in which the children of Israel were setting up camp, as it were, in Canaan. But they did find something that was a little bit more unusual than all of that in Shiloh, and it was this. It looks like a weird lump of rock, doesn't it? It doesn't look very interesting, but I'm going to turn to the Bible and then we'll come back to this image and then you'll have a bit more of a sense of what it means. This is from the book of 1 Kings. And it's telling us the story of a guy named Absalom. Absalom was the son of David. He had this whole drama where he tried to set himself up as king and it didn't work. Eventually, he fled off and grabbed hold of the horns on the altar. So let's read that. News came to Joab, for Joab had defected to Adonijah, though he hadn't defected to Absalom. So Joab fled to the tabernacle of the Lord and took hold of the horns of the altar. And King Solomon was told, Joab has fled to the tabernacle of the Lord, there he is by the altar. So Joab sided with the wrong guy, is the gist here. And in order to protect himself, he fled to the tabernacle and he grabbed hold of the horns of the altar. This is a reconstructed one, but it's actually made from bits and pieces of the fabric of the thing is actually from an archaeological excavation. And you can see there are four horns on the corner of the altar here. If you ever decide you want to read through the books of Ezekiel and Revelation, these four horns on the altar are really important. They relate to the fabric and the archaeology, not the archaeology, what am I trying to say? The architecture of the throne room of God. It's represented here in this altar. But that's another question for another day. So what these archaeologists had discovered was one of these pieces of the altar. They also discovered a whole bunch of these, which is just weird. We're talking Israel here. These are Egyptian scarabs. They date to about 1400 BC. A little further on than that, 1450. And that's incredible because that's exactly the time when the Bible tells us the children of Israel were departing Egypt in the Exodus. So they carried these things with them. This is the argument that's being made. They carried these things with them. They were still in use in Israel, even 100 years and so on beyond their departure out of Egypt. And they're beautiful little things, only tiny, the size of probably the size of your thumb. So as they continued to dig, they were finding all this evidence within Shiloh that this was a ritual site, which is an incredible thing. All of the different components of the tabernacle right there in the ground. Number 8, the Shoshenk list. Again, this one's really interesting. I'm going to say that a lot. I'm sorry. This, what you're looking at here, is actually a relief on the temple wall at Karnak in Egypt. It depicts right in the middle here, the guy who's sort of prominent in the middle. His name is Shoshenk. He's Shoshenk the First, actually, if you're interested in Egyptian history. And he's known in the Bible as Shishank. He's featured all through the book of 2 Chronicles, particularly in chapter 12, because he was the Pharaoh in Egypt at exactly the time when the nation of Israel started to fall apart. So if you know the history of Israel, you know that David was the greatest king of Israel. He followed on from Saul, who was a little bit rubbish, and God got rid of him and made David king. David was king for a while. He fought the Philistines a lot and anyone else he could get his hands on. And then his son Solomon came to the throne. Solomon did all right for a while, but at least his reign was a period of peace. But after Solomon died, people started squabbling over the throne. The nation fell apart. And then this guy shows up and this happens. 2 Chronicles chapter 12. Because all Israel had been unfaithful to the Lord, Shishak, the king of Egypt, attacked Jerusalem in the fifth year of King Rehoboam. With 1,200 chariots and 60,000 horsemen and the innumerable troops of Libyans, Succites, and Cushites that came with him from Egypt, he captured the fortified cities of Judah and came as far as Jerusalem. Then the prophet Shemaiah came to Rehoboam and to the leaders of Judah who'd assembled in Jerusalem for fear of Shishak, and he said to them, "This is what the Lord says, you have abandoned me, therefore I now abandon you to Shishak." Let's come back to the walls of Karnak. Now, just a bit of context here, you can see that the Pharaoh himself is the heel, the foot, that you can see in the very top right corner of the image here. And all of these slightly smaller men below, they're holding, they look like shields, but they're actually the names of all of the cities that these men occupied. So what's on the wall here in Karnak is, yes, the Pharaoh, and then the names of 187 cities that he conquered during this time period. It's actually just during one of his campaigns that's pictured on this wall. So there's 187 cities that are represented on this wall. And some of them you know. Some of them, if you know Israel at all, you would know cities like Gibeon. It's quite well known. Hebron, which today is the West Bank. Hebron today is Ramallah, which is where the Palestinian Authority hold their headquarters in the West Bank. And also Gath. If you remember Goliath, he came from Gath. At that point, it was owned by Israel and it was conquered by Shoshenk. But there is a really important difference, actually, between the way that the Israeli cities are represented on this wall compared to all the others. So if we look at the campaign of Shoshenk, he went all throughout the Middle East. He conquered a whole bunch of towns, and he said to them, essentially, you are my land now, you are my people. When it came to Israel, the people were so contentious that he decided he needed a different plan, and it's visible on this wall. So I'm going to zoom in. We're going to have a little bit more of a look here. So what you can see, these, I referred to them a minute ago, they look like shields. This is actually called a cartouche. And what it has here on the cartouche is the name of this particular city. This one is actually Gibeon. But what you can see, what the distinction is, and in fact, I think I'm going to make him bigger. What the distinction is, you can see over here on his arm, in red, he's bound. And he actually has He's bound at the elbows behind his back, which would be a pretty profoundly uncomfortable way to be tied up, I imagine. But what it's indicating is that Shoshenk, when he captured these cities in Israel, he didn't just capture them and say, "You're my people." He captured them, he enslaved them, he forced them to pay tribute. Essentially, they were captives in their own cities. It was a pretty brutal campaign that he ran. But of course, this is also exactly what God told Israel would happen. And we just read it, didn't we, from 2 Chronicles 12. And so again, the history bears out the story that's there in the Bible. Number 7, the Mesha Stele. This is actually, if I had a top 10, this is not my top 10. This is a top 10, and you could construct any number of top 10s here, but this is an incredible discovery, and it's one that I think is actually a really, really important one for grounding the Bible in history. One of the probably most contentious things that historians have squabbled over when it comes to the Bible is the existence of King David. If you go back to the 1960s, for example, and you read scholarship on King David and the Bible and the establishment of the Jewish state, you'll find almost universally scholars say King David was a myth. They constructed him, they fabricated this whole story about his existence, and it was really just part of the mythology of the state in order to say, this is our land, this is our place, we had this great king. This breaks all of that. So the question of whether David was more than just a mythological figure is answered here. We're going to have a look very quickly at a couple more verses from 2 Kings chapter 3. So for a start, now Mesha, king of Moab, we've already got a historical figure identified here who we can connect to the text, was a sheep breeder, and he regularly paid the king of Israel 100,000 lambs and the wool of 100,000 rams. Right? So Moab currently are essentially paying tribute to Israel. This fits with the biblical picture because David subdued the kingdom of Moab and he made them pay tribute to him. But it happened when Ahab died that the king of Moab had had enough and he rebelled against the king of Israel. So King Jehoram went out of Samaria at that time and mustered all Israel. Then he went and sent Jehoshaphat to the king of Judah saying, "The king of Moab has rebelled against me. Will you go with me to fight against Moab?" And he said, "I will go up. I am as you are, my people as your people, my horses as your horses." So back to the stealer. There are two ways people pronounce steely at the bottom here, by the way, steely and stealer. So either is good. Now, if you don't know what a steely is, that's probably a good place for it to start. Essentially, it's a stone tablet that records a historical event. And there are actually a fair few of these that crop up archaeologically. And they're all significant because people are writing these things in order to demonstrate that they've won something. So in this case, it's the king of Moab who is... actually, this one was a boundary marker. And the king of Moab had put this between Moab and Israel as a sign to say, "Ha ha, I won a battle and I've conquered you and I'm better than you are." That's essentially the gist of what all of these things are, right? This was discovered in 1868, and it was in the ruins of a place called, in modern day speak, it's called Dibon, but the ancient capital of Moab was Dibon. So same place, the names just evolved over time. And the very first line on this stone, which actually you can't see, it's right at the top, says, "I am Mesha, son of Chemosh, king of Moab, a Dibonite." And it goes on to explain in detail how Mesha rebelled and defeated and subdued the Israelites. And it's all kind of in, you know, glorious detail. There's a saying, history is written by the victors. Very true here. So if you were to talk to the king of Israel and the king of Moab and say, "Hey, how did this battle go?" you'd get two very different opinions, right? And that's kind of how this is unfolding. But what's really interesting about this one, if we look at it historically, is that Mesha actually identifies for us who it is he's fighting against in the tablet here. And so actually it's in the white box on the left here. And it confirms the biblical account of a literal David. Now, this stone itself was actually commissioned by Mesha in 850 BC. So by this time, King David is already dead. But the box on the left says that he has defeated the kings of the house of David. This was the first inscription that was ever found that confirmed the existence of David out of stuff in the ground, as opposed to just a historical record in text. Now, there have been more of these found. There's one, another called the Tel Dan Stele, which again talks about the house of David and goes into detail about David and Solomon. That's a more recent discovery than this one, but I haven't included it because this is the one that changed the minds of scholarship when it came to King David. But there's something else on here, and it's in the box over on the right up here, and I don't expect you can see it, so I'm going to make it bigger. That's the house of David over on the left, as we discussed. And now on the right, you can see this nice blurry whatever it is there that doesn't probably mean a great deal to you. So let me make it a little bit more obvious. Now, there are four characters on the screen here, and I'm going to highlight them, and I'll read them to you. And then I want to see if anybody actually knows what it is. Bernie, you are excluded from this particular game. This is Yod. Hey. Vav. Hey. Anybody know what that means? Yahweh. This is the name of God. This is actually in Moabite script. Moabite script is actually very close to Proto-Hebrew, so we can read it reasonably well, and people have obviously transcribed this entire stele, and this is one of the things that stands out. Now, this is awesome because actually it shows you that what you're looking at here is not just someone's historical record. It's actually someone gloating over having defeated the children of God, which is pretty cool. Like this is as opposed as people get to God and his people, Mesha is, right? And so he's saying, "I defeated the house of David and I've defeated Yahweh." That's the point of the stone. And that's great, because if you're looking at this historically, as a historian, what you don't want is a whole bunch of writers who agree with your perspective already. So if you can find evidence from people who actually don't agree with you at all, there's no way that King Mesha is going to agree with the children of Israel and conspire to create a record of the existence of King David and the fact that they worship Yahweh. That's fantastic. Really great evidence that comes out of the ground. This also, by the way, is the earliest textual representation of the name of God, and it's not even in a Jewish text, which itself is incredible. Number six. Again, this one's really remarkable. This is quite recent. This was found in 2019, and it actually contains the most ancient Hebrew inscription ever found. It's been dated to 1400 BC, so let me just put you back in time here. We're talking about the Israelites having left Egypt in about 1440 BC. We know after that point, God makes them wander around in the desert for 40 years because they're disobedient. So they arrive in Canaan at about 1400. All kinds of evidence for that. We'll get to a bit more of that in a minute, actually. But fix that in your mind. 1400 BC is about the time of Joshua's conquest of Canaan. And we're going to start with a couple of verses from the Bible, and then we're going to come back to what this is and what it represents. Deuteronomy 11. Now it shall be, when the Lord your God has brought you into the land which you go to possess, that you shall put the blessing on Mount Gerizim and the curse on Mount Ebal. Listen to how that's phrased. That's really odd, right? You shall put the blessing on. Just remember that. Joshua 8. Joshua built an altar to the Lord God of Israel in Mount Ebal, as Moses, the servant of the Lord, had commanded the children of Israel. And he read all the blessings and the cursings. Now we're going to come back to this image, and I'm going to explain what you're seeing. It's actually quite hard to see the detail on this. I'm going to zoom in a little bit. But what you're looking at, before I do that, this is actually only about a 2-centimeter square piece of lead. It's a lead tablet. Lead tablets are not uncommon in the ancient world, partly because lead is actually really easy to inscribe on. It's a very soft metal. But it does hold its shape really well as well. And so it was used quite a bit for significant pieces of information were often stored on lead. So again, we've got some weird little bits of script here. Now, this one's quite faded, but it is legible on the tablet itself. They've done all kinds of different forms of spectroscopy and stuff on this to make the text stand out more. So bear that in mind. But what I do want to show you again is exactly what these three little glyphs mean, and we're going to play a game again, and we're going to see if you can recognize what they are. This is Yod, this is He, and this is Vav. Again, we have three of the four characters of the name of God. Now, this appears actually all over the place on the tablet on the other side. It's more clear on this side, but you might be sensing a bit of a pattern here. So again, yes, this is the name of God. And that's incredible on its own, but it's only a small part of the text. So I'm going to show you actually what the full text of the tablet reads. This is it. Cursed, 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 cursed by the God Yahweh. You will die cursed, cursed, you will surely die. Cursed by Yahweh, cursed, cursed, cursed. Apart from the obvious issues with vocabulary, you can kind of get the gist that what they're doing here is they're cursing their enemies. Now, Deuteronomy 11, let's remind ourselves of that again. It shall be, when the Lord your God has brought you into the land which you go to possess, that you shall put the blessing on Mount Gerizim and the curse on Mount Ebal. Now, you have this command from God that Joshua should put the blessing on Mount Gerizim, put the curse on Mount Ebal. Do I need to ask you where this was discovered? This was discovered on Mount Ebal. Another incredible piece of evidence, not only that the God of the Israelites was involved in this conquest of Canaan in 1400 BC, but that they took God's word very seriously and quite literally put the curse on Mount Ebal. Number five, you'll understand the caption on this one in a second. I'll go into that in a minute. What you're looking at here, this is an excavation that was undertaken in 1933. You can tell, actually, you can see the cars on the road off to the side. They're a little antiquated. by our current, they're not Teslas, put it that way. This dig was conducted by a guy named John Garstang, and he was really important in excavating Jericho. So Jericho, if you know, again, your Bible history, is a city that Joshua captured. He and his men showed up and they said to the Lord, "How do we take this city, Lord? It's the most fortified, defended city in all of Canaan." And God said, "Just walk around it for 7 days and blow some trumpets and the whole thing will fall down." And essentially, that's what he did. They walked around it for 7 days. On the seventh day, they blew trumpets and they shouted and the walls of the city fell down. There's all kinds of evidence for that, and I'm not going into it today, but if you're interested in that side of things, it's absolutely worth looking at. You can actually see, sorry, I'm diverting away here. You can see how when the walls of Jericho fell, they fell in such a way that it basically formed a 45-degree ramp that took the people up to the height of the city itself. And there's evidence of massive amounts of burning all the way through the city. They've uncovered thousands upon thousands of large jars that were full of the grain from the recent harvest that had all been burned and destroyed, things that don't make sense unless there's some kind of catastrophic event that's occurred. Anyway, this, right in the middle of all of that. So there's evidence here, even in this space of that catastrophic destruction I talked about in about 1400 BC. But what I want to focus on today is actually a little more morbid, and it's because it actually ties in with one of my favourite stories in the Bible, just because it's just plain gross. So we're going to turn to the book of Judges now, and this is Judges chapter 3. And it's a period in Israel's history, actually before we get to the kings themselves. So Israel are settled in the land, and God hasn't given them a king yet, and the people haven't demanded one yet. And so they're being ruled by a class of people called judges. So in chapter 3, we read this. "When the children of Israel cried out to the Lord raised up a deliverer for them, Ehud, the son of Gera the Benjamite, a left-handed man. By him, the children of Israel sent tribute to Eglon, king of Moab." This is important. Remember Eglon. "Now Ehud made himself a dagger. It was double-edged and a cubit in length." That alone is really important. Swords, daggers, anything like that in the ancient world, you're not talking about someone just whipping something up at a forge. You're talking about the equivalent of someone buying a Tesla, right? For someone to have a sword of that length and double-edged, a lot of work's gone into it. He's basically gone, "I'm going to buy a Tesla." And he fastened it under his clothes on his right thigh. "So he brought the tribute to Eglon, king of Moab. Now Eglon was a very fat man. And when he'd finished presenting the tribute, he sent away the people who'd carried it, but he turned himself back from the stone images that were at Gilgal and said, 'I have a secret message for you, O king.' He said, 'Keep silence,' and all who attended him went out. So Ehud came to him." Now he was sitting upstairs in his cool private chamber. "Then Ehud said, 'I have a message from God for you.' And he arose from his seat. Then Ehud reached with his left hand, took the dagger from his right thigh and thrust it into his belly. Even the hilt went in after the blade and the fat closed over the blade, for he did not draw the dagger out of his belly, and his entrails came out. Then Ehud went out through the porch and shut the doors of the upper room behind him and locked them." Is this what you're expecting when you came this morning? I love this story. It's just, it's awful. And one of the things actually that really does lend itself toward looking at the Bible as an authentic record of history is that it doesn't shy away from this stuff. This isn't a record of perfect people living in a perfect utopia. This is a record of very broken people doing very messed up things. And if you want to go out and say to the world, "Hey, we've got this incredible story for you," and other religions do this, they construct these flawless characters that don't have any problems ever and life is perfect, and they say, "You can have this too." The Bible says these people are all really broken and messed up and it's awful, but God's got a plan. It's a very different way of thinking, and it lends itself toward thinking that this is an authentic record. So coming back to this, this is the palace of King Eglon. So this is in the middle of Jericho. This is the palace where an obese king got impaled by an arm-long dagger and his fat flaps closed over the blade. Now you might wonder how they actually know that this is the palace, and Partly it's because of its size. You can actually see how big this is compared to the cars and so on in the background. It's a fairly large building. But the other thing is that they have discovered pottery all through this building that A, shows it was incredibly high status, and B, dates it to exactly this time period. Number four, the ivory throne. This is a really cool piece of history. What you're looking at on the screen now is actually a very small piece of carved ivory. It's actually only about 2.5 centimetres in length from one end to the other. And it's a really intricately carved artifact. It was discovered in a parking lot in Israel. Now, what was happening was that there was a particular building that needed to expand its parking. They decided, we're going to dig up all the space around the building and then we'll lay down a parking lot over the top. As soon as they started digging, they realized they had to stop because they were finding things that were incredibly high status objects, including this and including a whole bunch of other stuff that looked like this. They found more than 1,500 fragments of these tiny little ivory carved plates. I'm going to divert from the image for a moment. We're just going to have a look at a couple of verses from the book of 1 Kings. Oh, no, we're not. From Judges, chapter 3. Yeah, that's all right. Let's do that. So King Solomon had made 200 large shields of hammered gold. 600 shekels of gold went into each shield. He also made 300 shields of hammered gold. 3 miners of gold went into each shield. The king put them in the house of the forest of Lebanon. This is definitely not Judges. This is 1 Kings chapter 10. I've got the wrong thing on the top. Moreover, the king made a great throne of ivory and overlaid it with pure gold. The throne had 6 steps and the top of the throne was round at the back. There were armrests on either side of the place of the seat and 2 lions stood beside the armrests. 12 lions stood there, one on each side of the 6 steps. Nothing like this had been made for any other kingdom. That's important on its own. Now, when we're talking about an ivory throne, we're actually talking about not the kind of throne that you probably more often than not would see in images. We're not talking about some giant seat that someone sits on. Thrones in the ancient Near East were like beds. They were long and you would recline on them. And what that would mean was that the person would come in and they would see the king and they'd be like, wow, he must be powerful because he's just chilling and everyone else is standing around holding spears and looking anxious, right? So it's communicating the fact that you're powerful because you just don't care about the concerns of the world. So that's the kind of thing that we're talking about here. Now, once all of these artifacts had been painstakingly reassembled, and you can imagine doing a jigsaw puzzle with all these things, something started to emerge, and that is that normally, if you were to look at these types of artifacts from the ancient world, you would expect them to be covered with divinity. There'd be leopards on them, which were really common in the ancient Near East as a symbol of power and might and strength. There'd be gods carved all over them. There'd be the sun with rays coming down if you were in Egypt, and all of these types of things, right? There's none of that here. There are lotus flowers, there are rosettes, there are vines, there's fruit, but there's none of that sort of typical ancient Near Eastern extravagance. It's just not there. The mythology is not incorporated into this artwork. And that's important. You see, the Jews are actually really quite unique in this respect in the historical record. They didn't make images of things like that in the same way that all the nations around them did. And do we know why? Because God had told them, you shall not make for yourself a graven image of any of these types of things. If you've ever wondered why that is, it's not just about idolatry. It's about God saying to his people, I want you to actually look different. It's not just that you're going to behave different, you're going to be different to everyone around you. There's going to be all this distinctive stuff that means that you don't look like them, right? Now, if you're in the room today and you're a Christian, that applies to you. You should not look like them. That's a whole other sermon. But this is a really incredible thing. So when the archaeologists compared all these carvings, they sat down and they looked at them all side by side by side. And they found that this type of ivory carving invariably belonged to kings and queens. And invariably, it was part of these ivory-laid thrones. We could go way more into detail. Ivory thrones appear a lot in the Bible, actually. A lot more than I expected, even. But further analysis of all of this stuff dated it to the 8th century BC. That is the time of Solomon. We're going to jump ahead in time. We are now coming to the time of Jesus. This is the James Ossuary. An ossuary, if you don't know what it is a stone box. That's all it means, quite literally, actually, all it means. Now, in this instance, and in fact, probably in most instances, these boxes are made out of limestone. There are some examples of these being made out of lead, but that's really unusual and not actually necessarily suggestive that more money's been put into them. Oddly enough, limestone seems to have been more prized than lead at this point in time. These were used for depositing the bones of the dead. Actually, it's a little bit more gross than that. So what would happen is that when somebody died, they would take the body, they would place it in a tomb. You know what? I can relate this back. Do you remember when Jesus' body is taken down from the cross? Nicodemus takes the body and he places it in a tomb in which no body had been laid. Has that ever struck you as weird? That's an odd thing to say. But what it's saying fits with this. What they would do is they would take the body of a deceased person, they would put them in a tomb, and they'd be in the tomb for a year. They would let the body decompose, and then they would take it back out and put the bones in a box. It's a really typical Jewish ritual from the first century, and that's exactly what we're talking about here. So this box is actually quite large. It's about half a meter long, about 50 centimeters long, and about 30 centimeters high. Now, what's unique about this one is it has an inscription on the side that, again, you won't be able to read. What I'm going to do, I'm going to enhance this a little bit. This is in ancient Hebrew, so that automatically also rules most of us out. But it says this, James, son of Joseph, the brother of Yeshua, Yeshua being the name of Jesus. Now, since 2012, this has been so contentious. This box was immediately written off as being a forgery. It went through 7 years worth of trials in Israeli courts. And essentially what happened was the guy that came forward with the box was dragged through the courts and accused of being a forger and of stealing antiquities and all kinds of stuff. And at the end of it all, they were like, yep, sorry, that's our bad. They let him go. So what's remarkable actually is that since 2012, when all of this stuff happened, this box has been through literally every test under the sun. It was examined by paleographers from Hebrew University who looked at all the text that was on the side of the box and said, yes, this is authentic text. Yes, it was carved in the first century. Yes, we can see evidence even inside of the grooves of the carving to show that there has been almost 2,000 years worth of buildup on the lettering of dust and all kinds of other debris that would have been in the tomb. They confirmed the typography. They confirmed that, yes, it looks like first century writing, because that's developed over time too. And they even did tests to determine the age and chemical composition of the patina. Patina is a word for just build up over time, of both the inside of the box, the outside of the box, and as I said, inside the grooves of the lettering. Finally, by the time we get to 2018, the Israeli Antiquities Authority appointed a committee of scholars to say, we've had all this evidence to suggest that this is genuine. We're still not really sure, so we're going to do it again. They went through actually about 40 different scholars who came together and did incredible tests on these things, scientists and scholars, and they returned at the end of it all a unanimous result. The result was the box is genuine, the inscription is genuine, the contents are genuine, the date is genuine. Now, of course, none of that proves that James, the son of Joseph, the brother of Jesus, is in fact the James, the son of Joseph, the brother of Jesus, right? There could be two. Who knows? So they did the stats on that too. They sat down and they looked at the statistical probability, looking at every single piece of text they had available to them to say, how many Jameses were living in Jerusalem in the first century AD? How many of them would have been the son of Joseph? How many of them would have had a brother whose name was Jesus? Actually, these names are really common, so the probability is actually higher than perhaps it otherwise could be. But the probability that they worked out was that at any given point in time in Jerusalem, in the first century AD, between about 0 and about 50, there would have been 1.71 people, potentially, who were James, the son of Joseph, the brother of Jesus. So what are the odds that this is a genuine ossuary box with the bones of James, the brother of Jesus? Pretty high. Very cool discovery. Number two, this one's called the Jesus boat. That's an AI image. Don't get thrown off by that. That's just to show you what they kind of maybe sort of would have looked like. That was a weird process, by the way. Asking AI to put together a boat, really hard. What's wrong with AI? Can't quite figure out where all the planks and ropes go. Anyway, this is a discovery from 1986, and it's a boat. It's a boat that was found in a period of severe drought in Israel, and it was found in Galilee. Now, the waters of the Sea of Galilee had been dropping for months, and I actually remember at the time reading stuff. I read a couple of Israeli archaeology sites fairly regularly, and I remember reading about things that people were finding along the seashore and thinking, oh, that's pretty cool. There were two brothers who were both absolute nerds. They were really keen archaeology buffs, and they'd heard about people finding Roman coins and things like that along the shores of the Galilee in the mudflats that had been exposed. And they were like, oh, we can go out, we can do that ourselves. So they went out, and one day they found this weird piece of wood sticking out of the mud. And they thought, well, that's kind of interesting. Wonder what that attaches to. And so they started digging. And in fact, as they were digging, they started to think, we could have a boat here. They contacted the Israeli Antiquities Authority, and as soon as people found out that there was a boat, the story spread that the boat was full of gold, which it wasn't. However, it meant that for the remainder of the dig, they had to operate 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, with security around the boat. So there's all these guys out there on a mud flat, digging with little trowels, with heavily armed security guards. And I mean heavily armed. They were strapped with bulletproof vests and AK-47s and all kinds of things. They were really armed to the teeth. Anyway, let me show you the image. So this is the boat. It's actually not all that different from the AI image. I did get there eventually, but you can see that there's only a certain amount of it left. Some of it's been destroyed by the water level and so on. This was all underneath the mud, and there was really just one part of it that's kind of toward the back, actually, that was sticking up out of the mud initially. But when it was first discovered, it was, you had a meter and a half of mud that they had to take out from the middle of this thing. So it took them 12 days and nights after they had the notification to the Israeli Antiquities Authority and they got their security set up, 12 days and nights around the clock they dug to get this thing out. And they were so worried, actually, that it was going to be destroyed by exposure to the elements that they created new processes for protecting the wood. So they coated the whole thing in fiberglass. They then coated the fiberglass in insulating foam. And then when they removed the boat, which they did with a crane by supporting it all from underneath, they took it to a museum that had a specially prepared very large vat. And the vat was filled with wax, boiling wax. They dipped the whole thing in the boiling wax and they actually left it there for years, 12 years, in order to ensure that it would be permanently preserved when they took it out for display. So this is actually now in an Israeli museum in the Galilee. And it's become known as the Jesus boat. Now, there's a good reason for that. We obviously don't know that Jesus ever stood in this exact boat. But it is a boat that was found on the shores of Galilee. And we do know that this boat was in use during the time of Jesus, which is pretty cool. So that's been authenticated by the fact that A, there was pottery all around the boat when they found it. And B, really helpfully, there was a piece of pottery trapped in the boat in between a couple of the bits of wood that actually dated from about 30 AD. So that's awesome. That's really helpful. They also did radiocarbon dating on it. They did dendrodating on the wood. All of it came back to the dendrodating was a period from about 40 BC to about 40 AD. That's a big window. But the pottery itself gave them a more narrow window because it was quite unique. But again, a really cool find. And as I say, we don't know that Jesus ever stepped foot in this particular boat, but he certainly stood in one like it 2,000 years ago. Number one, the final nail. Hopefully you get the pun. And we've come a long way, but as so often, and every time I preach I say this, I've had to leave so much out. There is so much relating to Jesus. There's so much relating to places like Jericho, and particularly to ancient Israel, the construction of the temple I haven't talked about at all. There's so much evidence. There's a project going on in Israel at the moment that's the Temple Mount Sifting Project. Israel doesn't have access to the Temple Mount because essentially it kind of, they handed it over to the Arab nations, to Jordan in particular, in 1967. There's a great deal of destruction that goes on the Temple Mount, and they just dump all the refuse over a fairly sheer cliff face on the side. When the Israelis saw that the Jordanians were doing this stuff, they decided that what they would do is grab everything they threw out and sift it. And they've found so many incredible things. I did a series on this actually with the kids at Good News. One of my favourite pieces was they found a signet ring that actually had the name of one of King Hezekiah's servants on it. Just incredible stuff that they found there, and it's rubbish to the Muslim nations, but to the Jews, it's, you know, incredible stuff. We're going to engage with this last one in actually a slightly different way, and I'm not going to show you what it is until we've read this. This is Psalm 22. My God, why have you forsaken me? Why are you so far from helping me and from the words of my groaning? Oh my God, I cry in the daytime, but you do not hear, and in the night season, and I'm not silent. I am a worm and no man, a reproach of men, despised by the people. All those who see me ridicule me. They shoot out the lip, they shake the head, saying, he trusted in the Lord, let him rescue him. Let him deliver him, since he delights in him. All my bones are out of joint. My heart is like wax. It has melted within me. You've brought me to the dust of death. The congregation of the wicked has enclosed me. They've pierced my hands and my feet. I can count all my bones. They look and stare at me. They divide my garments among them, and for my clothing they cast lots. The Psalms, many of them, were written by King David. This one dates to 1015 BC. It's 1,000 years before Jesus. Doesn't that sound like this? This is the heel bone of a man who was crucified in the 2nd century AD. This was actually discovered earlier this year, and it's from Britain. This one matters because before this one was discovered, there was only one other concrete, as in out of the ground, archaeologically discovered piece of evidence that confirmed that the Romans practiced crucifixion, which is incredible. Plenty of historical records, plenty of text, but nothing like this had been found, bar one very contentious heel bone that was discovered in Jerusalem. So this heel bone belonged to someone who suffered the same cruel fate that Jesus did. It's not unique, as I say. There have been other heel bones found. There was one found in another ossuary box, actually, in Jerusalem. But it was really controversial, and it wasn't accepted by everyone in the academic community for a number of different reasons, which is actually very typical of these types of things anyway. But this discovery silenced that criticism. But what this bone represents is actually more than that. It represents the fulfillment of something that was said by King David in 1015 BC. And whether you're a believer or not, this is where this story shifts. This is where we move away from, doesn't history disprove the Bible, to how on earth is someone in 1015 BC writing in gruesome detail something that's going to happen to Jesus in the first century? Because there's actually another twist here. You see, the earliest historical record that we have for crucifixion at all comes from the Greek writer Herodotus. He wrote about an incident in 522 BC in which there was a tyrant in a local province. Everybody hated this tyrant, and eventually there was a coup. He was killed, and the people hated him so much that even though he was already dead, they took him out and they strung him up on a cross. But that's the only record we have. We have no record of crucifixion ever occurring before 522 BC. David wrote this in 1015 BC. How did he know? Let me leave you with one final verse. Isaiah 46, I am God, there is no other. I am God, there is none like me. I declare the end from the beginning, and from ancient times, things that have not yet come to be. So we can answer that question today, can't we? Doesn't the Bible disprove history? No. Our God writes history. And the evidence for that is right before us. Let's close in prayer. Father, as people who are bound by time, it's hard for us sometimes to comprehend these things. And it can be hard to know even what to do with a book that has history written in advance in ways that we can't even understand. And maybe for some of us, Lord, that's hard this morning. Maybe we don't want to allow those dots to connect in our minds or in our hearts. Maybe we don't want to concede that someone like King David could write 1,000 years in advance in incredible, painstaking detail what was going to happen to Jesus. And yet, there it is. So, Lord, it's a strange request, but I would pray this morning that for those who have not yet seen and understood that you are the God who writes history in advance, that this would eat at them. Don't let us relax with these questions, Lord. Cause us to grapple with them, to wrestle with you, even as we read Jacob did in the Old Testament, wrestled with you all night. Help us to wrestle with these questions. And for those of us who are believers, Father, help us to be confident in the answers that we see in the text emerging from the ground. You are a great God, and you have done so much to demonstrate that you are not only outside of time, but you are orchestrating time, and that all of it points to Jesus. I thank you, Father, that history does not disprove the Bible. It confirms it day after day, page after page. And I thank you for it. Amen.